It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Egypt inaugurates a new president. Residents of Benghazi grow weary of militia violence. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Former Egyptian Army Chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has been sworn in as Egypt's new president a little more than a week after winning a landslide victory that was never in doubt. The ceremony took place Sunday at the Supreme Constitutional Court in Cairo, with Mr. Sisi pledging to support the interests of the Egyptian people. He pledged to the poor and those with low incomes a better life in the upcoming 4 years. Mr. Sisi comes to power nearly a year after he and the army toppled the previous president, Islamist Mohamed Morsi, whose supporters in the Muslim Brotherhood boycotted the election. Mr. Sisi said the Brotherhood has no future in Egypt. Thousands of Sisi supporters gathered late Sunday in Cairo's Tahrir Square, waving flags and cheering. Mahmoud el-Damarati says, "We came to celebrate the field marshal," a reference to Mr. Sisi's role as army chief, "because we felt that we have a new president who will rise to our expectations." Mr. Sisi faces considerable challenges, including ongoing violence and a shattered economy. Residents of the eastern Libyan city Benghazi say their daily lives have been disrupted by weeks of fighting among pro- and anti-Islamist militia. Mohamed Omar says schools, universities, and state institutions have stopped functioning. He says we can't even take money out of the bank. We want stability and security to prevail in the country. The fighting has caught the attention of the United States, with spokesperson Marie Harf saying Washington is watching events closely.
We know there are a variety of reports out there. We are attempting to get the best facts on the ground that we can. And we've said we're concerned about the security situation in Libya and the political situation as well. We know there's still a long way to go in this, what at times has been a very bumpy transition. But that the Libyans have an opportunity for a better future here. It's up to them to decide. We'll keep working with them on all of these different issues. So, of course, we remain concerned, but it's something we're very focused on.
And the UN Human Rights Office has denounced the violence, saying killings, human rights abuses, and other forms of repression are escalating at an alarming rate. Lisa Schlein has the story in Geneva.
Spokesman Rupert Colville says people in Libya, especially in Benghazi, are being killed and injured because no legal restraints are put on the perpetrators. He says people know they can get away with the crimes they commit.
The government effectively is unable to exercise control over a large number of armed brigades. It's a major concern. The government doesn't have effective control over the whole country. At all.
Colville says different armed groups are involved in these attacks and violations. But while there are laws on the books, he says they are not being implemented. He says Libya's judicial system is broken. Beyond the deteriorating security concerns, he says there are many human rights concerns.
For example, 7,000 people who continue to be deprived of their liberty without regard for due process.
Colville says the condition of people detained in government-run facilities is also far from ideal. The United Nations published a report late last year focusing on the situation of torture and deaths in detention throughout Libya. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The African Union mission in Somalia, AMISOM, has handed over 4 large water wells to the administration of Mogadishu's Banadir region as part of efforts to rebuild the country. James Gadden is AMISOM's political affairs officer.
Just to complement our military efforts on the ground, it's common sense for us to try to uplift the living standards by providing basic social services to the population in those areas that we recover from Al-Shabaab. In many of these places, we find some dilapidated social infrastructure, some even non-existent. For those that are dilapidated, it's easier for us to rehabilitate them. And particularly with regards to portable water supply, that's what we've done.
Only about 30% of Somali people have access to clean water, leaving many prone to chronic illnesses. Dozens more migrants from Syria and Africa were rescued at sea near Malta Sunday. Italy rescued thousands of migrants over the past few days. Thousands have died making the dangerous journey from North Africa. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, June 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former Egyptian Army Chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi was sworn in Sunday as the country's new president.
Facing growing resentment over the military's crackdown on dissent and an economy on the brink of ruin, the former army chief promised to build a more stable country after 3 years of upheaval and called for the development of freedom.
That's VOA correspondent Edward Urania in Cairo. Mostly women and children were said to be killed over the weekend during violent attacks in eastern DRC. Nigeria's former central bank governor is named the new emir of Kano, and South Sudan is unhappy with a rebel news conference in Khartoum, but Sudan denies any support.
There are so many southerners in Khartoum, and maybe some of them declare something or say something to the newspaper. This is not, but we allow him as government.
Achmed Bilal is Sudan's Minister of Information, and there's concern in Uganda over the rise of an unprecedented mob justice. Those stories plus Marco Oman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi was inaugurated Sunday as Egypt's eighth president, less than a year after he helped oust the country's first freely elected leader, Islamist Mohamed Morsi. Edward Urania reports for VOA from Cairo.
Abdel Fattah el-Sisi took the oath of office Sunday at Egypt's Supreme Court as the country's top justices, government officials, and foreign dignitaries looked on. Mr. Sisi is Egypt's eighth president since the monarchy was toppled in 1952. Deputy Supreme Court Chief Justice Maher Sami, who presided over the ceremony, asked that God spare Egypt from further woes, saying that too much blood has been spilled during 3 years of political upheaval. He went on to argue that a popular revolution, rather than a military coup, swept Islamist President Mohamed Morsi from office last July. Egypt's constitution specifies that a new president be sworn in before the country's parliament, but the absence of a popularly elected assembly forced the alteration of normal procedures. Elections for a new parliament are expected to take place by mid-July as Egypt tries to restore normal democratic institutions. Arab leaders, including King Abdullah of Jordan, the Emir of Kuwait, the King of Bahrain, Saudi Crown Prince Salman, and the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, were welcomed by an honor guard at the presidential palace after the ceremony. Both the U.S. and the EU sent mid-level delegations, while the leaders of Turkey and Qatar, with whom relations are strained, were not invited. Political sociologist Saeed Sadiq argued on Sky News Arabia that the recognition of Egypt's new leader by the international community is expected to help restore stability to the country. He adds that the economy is also likely to get a boost from the return to normal political institutions. Sunday was declared an official holiday for the swearing-in ceremonies, and the streets of the capital, Cairo, were mostly empty. Security was tight, and military checkpoints had been set up on strategic bridges and thoroughfares. Egyptian officials also appeared to be closed-lipped about exact details of where and when celebrations would take place in the afternoon, although crowds are expected to gather in Cairo's iconic Tahrir Square later in the day for popular celebrations. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
South Sudan's representative presidential spokesman has accused the neighboring Sudan of undermining the legitimacy of President Salva Kiir's government after representatives of rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar were allegedly allowed to hold a news conference in Khartoum during the weekend. The delegation was in Sudan as part of preparations for an expected visit to that country by Riek Machar. Attorney, work attorney, also criticized Kenya for giving what he called Michelle a red carpet presidential treatment during his recent meeting with President Uhuru Kenyatta. Attorney tells reporter Peter Clotty the preferential treatment given to Michelle is an assault to South Sudan and its citizens.
This is an attempt to undermine the legitimate government in Juba.
But where lies the freedom of speech? Your constitution allows freedom of speech. So if an opposition member is allowed to speak freely in a neighboring country, why should it be a problem to your administration? And why should the government in Juba say that it is undermining its legitimacy?
We have it. Under Article 24 of our constitution guarantees the freedom of expression inside the country here. But the type of opposition in South Sudan is an opposition that is taking arms to change the government. And if it happens to even to the United States of America, the America would protest that.
Your government has also protested the meeting of Riek Machar and Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta recently, saying that President Kenyatta should not host or meet Riek Machar. Why is your government doing this when you want to find a way of resolving this peacefully through dialogue?
My brother, you are a very informed journalist, and you know that, you know, the red carpet is not given to people other than the head of the state of a sovereign country. For the government of Kenya to accord, a rebel leader, a red carpet is an insult to the sovereignty of South Sudan. Every country has opposition that, you know, is elected to be in the parliament, but at the same time, they are not accorded a red carpet when they are visiting a foreign country. If Raila Odinga come to South Sudan, we cannot give him a red carpet. Why should Kenya do that? It's an insult to the Republic of South Sudan.
But he was a former vice president, and the Kenyan president, as you know, is one person who is trying to help resolve this conflict. So if, according him, some form of comfort will help resolve the issues in South Sudan, why shouldn't that be done? Why should that be an offense?
If the president of Kenya was, hosting the rebel leader in South Sudan on the basis of his being former vice president, it should have been William Ruto doing that. William Ruto is the vice president of Kenya, and there's no need for President Kenyatta to receive somebody who was a vice president. His counterpart is none other than Salva Kiir Mayardit. He can receive President Salva Kiir, but he cannot. Okay, if he received the rebel leader in an attempt to bring the two sides closer to each other, then he should not accord him a red carpet. Otherwise, that one is a violation of international law by according, a rebel leader that is attempting to overthrow a legitimate government.
Attorney Work Attorney is South Sudan's presidential spokesman. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Juba. Sudan's Minister of Information, Ahmed Bilal, has again said his country will not take sides in the South Sudan conflict. Instead, he said Khartoum wants to be part of the solution by working with the African Union and the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, known as IGAD, which is mediating a solution to the conflict. This comes after South Sudan's presidential spokesman, Attorney Work Attorney, accused Khartoum of undermining the legitimacy of President Salva Kiir's government after representatives of rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar were allegedly allowed to hold a news conference in Khartoum over the weekend. Bilal tells me the government does not control the many South Sudanese in Sudan.
Actually, we are taking, not aside anybody in the war which are erupting now in the south. And the rebels, they want to come to visit Sudan, and we didn't give them a visa. But there are so many southerners in Khartoum, and maybe some of them declare something or say something to the newspaper. This is not, but we allow him as government. I can assure again, our official status, we are quite actually speaking and searching with the Africans and with IGAD to solve the problem, not to make it more actually siding the rebels or something like that. Before they said we are training them and we are this, and this came to be false. Now they are saying they make a news conference or something like that. I can assure you this is nothing happened.
Another story I have is that Sudan Congress Party Chief Ibrahim Al-Sheikh was taken away from the home in Nuhu town of West Kordofan by police. Do you know if any opposition leader was arrested by Sudanese police?
Actually, you know, as I told you, I was away from the country just now. I came 1 hour ago from Cairo. We went to the inauguration of Sisi. Ibrahim Sheikh, as far as I know, 4 or 5 days ago, he said the same false accusation to the army as Sadiq al-Mahdi said before. Maybe he's arrested or something like that. I don't know. I'm not sure of that.
So, Minister, you said you just came back from Egypt. What kind of relationship is Khartoum looking for from Cairo?
In fact, actually, we respect the people of Egypt, and this is their choice. President Bashir called Sisi, and he congratulates him. And now we went with the vice president for the inauguration. We are looking forward for good relations with Egypt. Our relations will not be affected whether this is a coup or this is a democracy. And we think now he is elected president, and we are going to deal with him as an elected president.
Ahmed Bilal is Sudan's Minister of Information. He spoke with me from the capital, Khartoum. It is Monday morning, June 9th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Mostly women and children were said to be killed during violent attacks over the weekend in a village in the Democratic Republic of Congo's South Kivu province. According to Reuters news agency, the DRC government has blamed the attacks on a dispute over cattle. Sylvie Pillet, a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in nearby Bukavu, tells Ricky Shryak that tensions remain high in the village.
The tension was pretty high. In fact, by the time we had arrived, the wounded were already on their way down to Uvira. But then the ICRC team was still able to evacuate between 5 and 7 patients from Sangue to Uvira.
When you say the tensions were high, do you mean people feared another attack?
Difficult for me to say as I wasn't there per se, but the town of Mutahuri has been under a lot of tensions for decades. The town is basically split between two communities that don't get along very well. In August 2013, there's already been fighting basically between the two communities where 8 people died. That was last August, and 2,000 people were displaced. So it's kind of like just latent tensions between these two communities in that village in particular. We cannot, for the time being, cannot really confirm exactly what happened.
What are the two communities who have these tensions?
Bafulero and then Barundi. The name of the community is Barundi.
So there's two Congolese communities who have tensions.
Yes, exactly. The Barundi are like what are called in Congo from the Banyamulenge, so meaning from Rwandan origin, but like generations and generations ago. They've been in the Congo for a long time. Basically, the two communities live in this village.
Some reports have said that the perpetrators attacked women, children, patients in a hospital, and even several pregnant women. This seems like a particularly severely brutal attack. You said that there's been tensions around these communities for a while, but were the past attacks so brutal, or is this one more severe than past attacks?
This attack has been particularly, you know, brutal, as we were saying, like mainly, well, you know, civilians and mainly women and children, and were, I don't want to say targeted, because of course I don't know, but were the victims at least. For example, from the 10 people that were evacuated in Bukavu and that were taken in charge by our surgical team, we had like 3 minor girls, 1 minor boy, and 6 women of all age in terms of the women. I'm not concerned that this one was more brutal or less brutal than the other one. I think all attacks are always quite brutal anyways.
Are there fears that there will be a reprisal attack?
I cannot confirm this. As I said, you know, the situation is pretty tense. I think the population is afraid and would like to get, you know, more protection from the authorities. And the situation is here in Congo. It's very tense. And but I don't know. I think, of course, there are fears of maybe reprisal, but I think more that the population is just angry in general.
That was Sylvie Pele, a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Bukavu, the DRC. The former governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria, Lamido Sanusi, was Sunday chosen as emir of Kano, the second highest Muslim authority in Nigeria. His selection followed the death of his great uncle, Alhaji Ado Bayero, On Friday, at age 83, Sanusi was suspended from the central bank in February this year and has been an outspoken critic of the Goodluck Jonathan government. His election also comes as Kano is becoming increasingly restive in the wake of the Boko Haram insurgency. Aliu Yusuf is a resident of Kano with knowledge of the emir's succession process. He tells me Sanusi's selection has no political undertone.
The emir of Kano is seen as the father of all, more or less like a spiritual leader.
The spiritual leader of the Muslims in that area?
Yeah, more or less something like that. But he is seen as father. He's not particularly to be political or have inclination. He's supposed to be seen as a father figure to everybody, irrespective of tribe or religion that lives in Kano.
You say this is a religious title. Explain to our listeners, how does that fit in line with, say, the Sultan of Sokoto?
The Sultan, it stems down to the jihad of Uthman al-Fodio when he tried to Islamize the entire northern region. So the Sultan is the emir, the head, and then all the emirs are all like regional heads in their different domains.
Sanusi was suspended in February this year because of what was described as financial recklessness. In his appointment as emir, what is this saying? Is it saying that the religious people there don't believe the allegations against him?
No. This has completely nothing to do with his appointment as emir. Lamido Sanusi is a prince by birth. He's also a member of the royal family by way of being the grandson of Muhammad Sanusi, who was deposed sometime. So he is a prince and he is eligible to be emir of Kano. It has nothing to do with political. You know, in the incidence of where an emir dies, every prince is eligible. Every prince applies. So the kingmakers choose or decide who amongst the princes will become emir. So he also vied for the position of emir, has been a prince, and then he was chosen as emir.
In the wake of the Boko Haram situation, the violence, what role do you think this new emir, Mr. Sanusi, can play?
You see, I expect that the emir of Kano is supposed to be seen as non-political. He's supposed to be seen as being neutral. He's supposed to be seen as being cosmopolitan. He's supposed to be seen as being accommodative, not getting involved in incisive political statements. And you see, Kano being a restive place, the Kano people need someone that will be a neutralizing factor, just like the late emir. But lately, he has been known to be controversial, and his nomination as emir sparked protest in Kano, which means the people are not at home with his appointment.
Ali Yusuf is a resident of Kano with knowledge of the emir's succession process. He was speaking with me from Kano. The Uganda Human Rights Commission is calling for a study on what it says is an alarming rise in mob justice. As Hillary Hewler reports for VOA from Kampala, a backlog in the courts and a lack of trust in the justice system exacerbate the problem.
At Namwongo Fish Market in Kampala, vendors laugh and haggle with customers as they scale and chop fresh tilapia. The scene is peaceful enough, but Andrew Wafula, who sells fish, knows this isn't always the case.
Every Tuesday, that is a market day, and people sell the things there. Thieves, they always come, and if they come, they steal small things.
When someone spots a thief, he says, the whole market is swept up in a murderous rage.
If someone steals here in the market, people have to struggle to catch him. We as people, if we catch him, we have to hit him. That's the way we do.
According to the Uganda Human Rights Commission, or UHRC, mob justice in the country is on the rise. It calls the number of recent incidents unprecedented. This is leading to serious violations of human rights, and its causes should be investigated, says UHRC's Katebalirwe Irumba.
It is against our constitution and against the laws in this country.
No one knows the exact reason for the spike in violence, although Irumba points to youth unemployment and frustration as one probable factor. Another, says Wafula, is a widespread lack of confidence in a justice system that can easily be bought off by a suspect with a little cash to spare.
These days, if you go there and he has his people who has some money, they pay something, very little. Then they say, instead of taking him to the prison, let's set him free. If we reach in the hands of police, we will not be punished.
Gerald Abila, a lawyer who works with the poor, says most Ugandans don't see the formal justice system as a realistic way to solve their problems. The result is that in Uganda, getting caught for a crime like theft can mean a death sentence, carried out immediately, without a trial. But even as a market vendor, Wafula says he understands what can drive a person to steal. The UHRC wants to teach the public that mob justice is itself a criminal act. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with football. The Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe pipped Egypt's Zamalek 1-0 as Algeria's Entente Setif and Libya's El Ahli Benghazi drew 1-1 in Orange Africa Champions League action on Sunday. In an all-Tunisian showdown, Esperance edged CS Sfaxien 2-1, while the Democratic Republic of Congo's AS Vita and Sudan's El Hilal drew 1-1. Meanwhile, Ivory Coast's Sewe Sports and Egypt's El Ahli drew 1-1 in their Orange Africa Confederations Cup tie on Sunday. Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel outgunned Zambia's Nkana 4-3. Cameroon's Cotton Sport pipped Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa 3-2, as Congo Brazzaville's AC Leopards edged Mali's Real de Bamako 2-1. Elsewhere, Cameroon's team to the FIFA World Cup was hit by a crisis when players refused to board their plane from Yaounde, bound for Brazil on Sunday. The dispute centers on unpaid bonuses for their World Cup campaign. Talking to my colleague James Batty, Albert Njiembonde, a sports reporter of the Cameroon Radio and Television, has the details.
It was initially agreed that they will be giving the sum of 50 million silver francs per player, which is in dollars about $100,000 per player. But at departure time, we were told that the players raised the target to about $160,000. So the Minister for Sports in Cameroon, the interim FA president, were all into negotiations with some of the key figures of the technical staff as well as the captain of the team to find a solution. Unfortunately, flying time was delayed and then later reprogrammed for 9:30 p.m. Cameroon time, and then later to midnight, and then finally we are told that Cameroon time they are due to leave at 3 a.m. Another unofficialized information we are getting is that the players are asking for the resignation of some figures of the administration of our football, notably the Secretary General of the FA, and that they kind of deny to travel with some authorities of our football on the same flight.
That was Albert Njiembonde, a sports reporter with Cameroon Radio and Television, speaking in Yaounde, Cameroon. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Listener mail for this Monday morning comes from Mohamed Ahmed Masoor of Monrovia, Liberia. He says, "Dear VOA, I feel excited by the level of political maturity exhibited by the people of Egypt leading to the election and inauguration of Abdel Fattah el-Sisi as their president. Well done, Egyptians. This is a significant step towards democracy." Thank you, Mohamed Ahmed Masoor of Monrovia, Liberia, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's it for this Monday, June 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clutty and Ricky Shrike, I'm James Butte in Washington, saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Put your flags up in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your peek. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.